Tonight, we are dealing with Egyptian myths as they relate to the afterlife of man. So we must clarify not only our knowledge or lack of knowledge of the Egyptian life way, we must also clarify the different positions and convictions held within Egypt itself during a long period of its history. We cannot say, for example, that the Egyptian believed this or that. At different times, the Egyptians believed both this and that, and several other things. A people developing a culture over a period of nearly 5,000 years passed through innumerable phases and moved from one cultural platform or level to another. Therefore, during the long course of Egyptian religion, nearly every belief known to man today was contemplated and considered. Some of these beliefs never came to flowering. Others mingled in strange chemistries to produce effects we would consider fantastic. Still others moved inevitably toward philosophy and ultimately to science. Thus we have among Egyptian remains evidences of nearly every phase of mortal thinking, from theism through polytheism to monotheism to atheism. It is impossible, therefore, to make some broad statement as to the way the Egyptian regarded his destiny in the universe. We only know with reasonable certainty that in addition to the development of indigenous beliefs within the structure of Egyptian society, Egypt was bounded by several other countries and also by other advanced cultures which variously contributed and modified Egyptian thought. We know the effect of the great dynasties of Ethiopian kings upon Egyptian learning. We know also the impact of Semitic thought from the valley of the Euphrates. We cannot fail to recognize the late appearance of Greek modification. All of these and other forces, some of them probably coming from far Asia, influenced the gradual development of Egyptian religion. Egypt, as the cradle of Mediterranean civilization, also exercised in its own turn a powerful influence upon later cultural patterns. A great part of Mediterranean culture, including arts, philosophies, religions, and sciences, a great part was modified or changed by Egyptian culture. And we can trace Egyptian elements in nearly all religions in the region, including Christianity. Thus, Egypt assumes a very important position in our thinking. And we must try to understand something of the experience through which the Egyptian passed in the development of its culture. Several Egyptologists insist that early Egypt was unaware of any monotheistic teaching, unless we assume such teachings to have been achieved in the Nome of Heliopolis. Actually, there is much to indicate that the early Egyptians did contemplate the possibility of one divine being at the root of life. This certainly did have its day of recognition during the reign of Amenhotep IV, whom we know as Akhenaten. This burial was a complete monotheist. But of course, this is attributed in part to the Semitic blood in his family. The Egyptian we know was early concerned with the state of himself after death. To study his art and the psychological impact of his numerous and diversified achievements is to come to one conclusion about which there seems to be no difference of opinion. The Egyptian loved life. He was not a person burdened with nostalgia or remorse. Even though in many periods he must have had a difficult time, his country was riddled with wars, his leadership was frequently inadequate. But above all, and in spite of all, he loved life. From the beginning, then, death was approached with a rather strange attitude. Death to the Egyptian was not a release from anything. He did not look forward to a blessed state in the world beyond. In the same spirit, death was not a reward for anything, because punishments and rewards were familiar to him, and he accepted them as part of his natural existence. We are not surprised, therefore, to find that there is no concept of heaven as we understand it, or conviction of hell as we fear it, in Egyptian religion. The Egyptian realized that the individual had to depart from this world. Naturally and inevitably, the Egyptian also believed and required the belief that death was not the end of human experience. It seemed much easier, even to the early Egyptians, to assume that death was merely a separation of a being from a body. The body returned to the earth, or perhaps later was magnificently embalmed and placed in a gaily ornamented sarcophagus. The Egyptian was convinced that the soul within the body lived on. He did not believe that death represented any essential change in the nature, temperament, disposition of the person. It was a change of place only, not a change of essential state. It never occurred to him that death would transform the living into superior beings or inferior beings. He was not, therefore, inclined actually to worship the dead, because it would be like simply worshiping some relative whose limitations we already recognize. This might seem to vary somewhat from the phenomenal facts available, but we must remember that the deification process in Egypt, like that in China, and essentially like that in ancient Japan prior to the rise of a comparatively recent efflorescence in Shintoism, that this deification of the dead was restricted to the ruler, inasmuch as Egypt was a theocracy. In Egypt, the king of Pharaoh was a god, was the embodiment of God, was the instrument of God in this world. He was the extension of the divine power into the human state. But early, the Egyptian made another discovery, which affected him considerably in his psychology of life. He realized that the Pharaoh is a symbol, and the Pharaoh is a person. These were two distinctly different things. Pharaoh is a symbol, as a concept was divine. But Pharaoh as a person was not always adequate, not always sufficient to his own divine responsibility. Thus, Pharaoh was an immortal mortal. He had divine attributes, and the concept was worthy of veneration and worship. But the Egyptian was too much of a realist to ignore the little man under the concept, to ignore the fallibility of the human being. In his religious art, therefore, even the great monumental productions of the state, Pharaoh must also ask for forgiveness. And like the Emperor of China, he must seek with the same humility as his people the presence of the great gods. Pharaoh was required to be an initiate of the state mysteries. And if he was unable to meet the requirements of these mysteries, he could not rule. Pharaoh in Egypt was a term which could be either male, female, or both. The Egyptian descent of royalty was essentially matriarchal. The descent was measured from the mother's side and not the father. Very often, brother and sister ruled together, therefore, as Pharaoh. And under such conditions, they were regarded as the visible divisions of an undivided, invisible power. Also, amazingly enough, if Pharaoh was a woman, she must wear not only male, but female attributes. And if Pharaoh was a man, he must also wear both male and female attributes. This is not uncommon in theocracies or divine states of government. The same is true in Tibet. The same was true in the rise of the Christian hierarchy, as the bishops, cardinals, and the pope wear vestments which combine male and female garments. Thus, if Pharaoh was a woman, she wore an artificial beard on state occasions. And the Pharaoh wearing the full regalia of his office, if he was a man, always wore suspended from his back the skin of a lioness, and was referred to as male before and female behind. Thus, the androgynous concept of Pharaoh also early developed within the Egyptian consciousness. Pharaoh as God, therefore, was regarded as having a unique destiny. But this destiny was not generally shared and was reserved for the members of the royal dynasty. For the rest, the Egyptian did not have what we would term any tendency, any pronounced tendency, either to deify his death or expect from them in another life attributes which they did not possess in this life. During the power of the scholar council of the pharaohs in Egypt, there was, however, a magical factor introduced. And in Egyptian religion, there is no essential division between theology and magic, any more than there was an essential division between theology and science. They were considered one body of learning. The Egyptian, because he believed and magical powers, frequently assumed a kind of spiritism. He believed that the dead did not necessarily depart happily, but if their bodies were returned to the dust and disintegrated, then their contact with the earth was gradually dissolved. The Egyptian dead, in the form of the man-headed hawk, is therefore constantly represented as seated at the foot of the mortuary couch, the soul gazing quietly upon the mummified face of its own body. To assure, therefore, a certain relationship between the living and the dead, the Egyptians developed the process of embalming their heroes, scholars, sages, priests, and great persons, binding them to their body by the perpetuation of that body. The Egyptian believed that he could hold the souls of the dead to the service of Egypt, that they could never fail to be present as long as their bodies were there. This probably underlies the concept of the mummification of the dead. The Christians later embalmed their dead, but this was for another motive, because the early members of the Christian communion believed, literally, that in the second resurrection, or in the resurrection of the dead, the human being would reinvest his body, and that the body should be preserved for this purpose. The Egyptian, however, did not mummify from any such considerations. The dead, consequently, for the most part, particularly in early times, were buried in the knee-chest position, which is called the embryo posture. They were placed in a comparatively circular opening in the ground, sometimes lined with bricks. This knee-chest posture, or embryo position, was to indicate that the deceased person was passing into a kind of second infancy, or was to be reborn in another world. Therefore, that his grave was the embryo of another life, that he was to be born from the earth as from a womb. Not, however, was this birth to be regarded as different, merely in another place. And in this other place, the Egyptian believed firmly that the state of the deceased person would be determined and measured by his earthly condition. If, therefore, he had made certain achievements during his material lifetime, he would continue to enjoy these achievements. If he did not achieve, he would not have the same degree of enjoyment. Later, magic came in again. And so literal did the concept of the afterlife become in the Egyptian consciousness that it was considered proper, in fact, obligatory, to bury with the dead any such belongings, household goods, ornamentations, raiment, and even food that the soul might need in the afterlife. There was a time at which the Egyptian, like many other ancient people, the Chinese, for example, actually believed that the deceased person lived his second life in his own grave. Therefore, his grave was usually a series of rooms or apartments suitable to supply him with all pleasures and conveniences. The walls were well decorated, not only with pleasant scenery, but with admonitions to morality, virtue, and ethics, so that he might live in the constant sense of improvement. He was supposed to enjoy his afterlife in the same way that he had enjoyed his material estate. Later, the articles buried with the dead were reduced to symbolical equivalents. And it was believed that a tiny image of a servant was just as good as the servant. The Egyptian apparently had already learned to realize that in some mysterious way the utility of these objects depended not upon themselves, but upon the mind of the person who was deceased. If the mind of the dead vitalized these objects, they became useful. If this mind did not vitalize them, they did not become useful. Later, we find the gradual rise of one of the most important cults of Egypt, and that was the rise of the great Osirian cycle, centering around the deity Osiris, who was regarded as the son of Saturn, and held later by the Greeks and Latins to be the equivalent of their Zeus or Jupiter. Osiris, however, combined in one person the attributes of many deities, and a number of later mythologies borrowed phases of these attributes. The philosophy of the Egyptian about Osiris is probably more profound than we realize. And here again, we must pause for a second. Let us remember that Egypt was not a savage or untutored land. As we look upon the great architectural monuments of this people, we know that they were learning. We know also that we have a psychological tendency to discredit the learning of the past, or to depreciate anything that might cast a shadow on our own grandeur. But let us face it, the Egyptian was a civilized man. He was a thoughtful man. He had nearly every problem that we know today. We have this from the records. He suffered from high taxes and protective tariffs. He knew very much about debt. He had to borrow money at usurious rates of interest. He recognized property laws. He recognized social obligations. His courts were highly legislated and legalized. His jurists were well trained. His physicians were informed according to the best standards of their times. His scholars were educated. His philosophers were wise and noble. We cannot then assume that a man of this kind, or descent of such men, would over a series of thousands of years affirm the literal acceptance of fables and legends. We must more rightly observe that the sacerdotal mysteries of these people were concealed beneath obligations and oaths. And because they were part of the initiate system of antiquity, they veiled their doctrines in allegories and fables. We have accepted the fables as the facts, and because most of the ancient records are lost, if they were ever committed to writing, which is very doubtful, we have no way of correcting our own perspective. We can only suspect, and perhaps with generosity of spirit, acknowledge that these people must have had religions and philosophies suitable to their estates and reasonable to their attainments. This is true also of Greece, which is perhaps a more immediate and more pressing example. For we know that Pythagoras and Plato and Aristotle and Euclid were not foolish, superstitious men, and that the philosophies and theologies which they venerated could not have been merely lore and legendary. In Egypt, therefore, the moment we come upon a great cycle, such as the Osirian cycle, we must begin to parallel it with other comparatively equivalent cycles, such as the great Vedic cycle of India, and the Puranas and Bharatas. We can also see in it the Theogony of Hesiod, and the great epic poems of Homer. We can parallel it with the Bharata, the Mahabharata, and the Ramayana, all of the great sagas of the Nordic peoples. These were tremendous accounts of things mysteriously set forth. Osiris in Egypt must then have not only been regarded as a deity by the humble, the uninformed, and the unschooled, but must have stood in the presence of the informed and the enlightened for principles, for realities, which they could comprehend and which their intelligence would demand. We are not therefore surprised to discover that the Egyptians early recognized Osiris as one deity within which a division of deities took place. Isis, Nephthys, Anubis, Typhon, Horus, these deities were not separate from Osiris. They were the very parts and members of himself. So we are able to appreciate why the 42 assessors of the dead in the ritual of the psychostasia are all supposed to have been aspects of the deity himself, the God within whom all these things live and move and have their being, and that gods and goblins are really not separate creatures, but phases or aspects of one creature, one being. And this being for the Egyptian of the Middle Period was Osiris. He recognized Osiris in four principal attributes or forms. And these in themselves should tell us that we stand at the gate of a great philosophy. Osiris was first Osiris Tar, or my Lord the Light. Tar was the light of the mind and the light of the world. But it was more than intellect. It was the light which enlightened intellect. Therefore, perhaps Osiris Tar was the Egyptian name or formula or symbol for the term that we call consciousness. Osiris Tar was a potter. He was a great artificer, and he fashioned all things upon a potter's wheel in the Nome of Memphis. Osiris Tar fashioned first the great egg of the world, from which sprang forth both gods and men. Osiris Tar was also the architect, the base and substance of those archetypal designs which are to be everywhere manifested through creation. Thus, the primary aspect of the deity was consciousness, containing within itself the design of all things, and manifesting that design through the initial action of creation, or as the Egyptians would insist, of generation. Because the Egyptians did not believe in spontaneous creations from nothing, they believe in eternal generations from antecedent causes. This is one of their basic tenets. The second phase of Osiris was Osiris Horus. And here we find the peculiar relationship of father and son. The father who is his own son. The son who is his own father. The son who is the only begotten of the father. The son who bears witness. The son through whom the father must be approached. The son who must intercede before the father for the souls of the righteous dead. Horus, therefore, in the Egyptian symbolism, is certainly a representation of what we call mind. Mind as the firstborn of consciousness. Mind as the eldest creature of reality and truth. Mind as the source of ego, or the existence of selfhood. So that all things in themselves and of themselves are sons of the Father. And that all things partake of this parenthood and bear witness. Thus, Osiris Horus is actually the symbol of the conscious, individualized intellect, which is rooted in universal consciousness and is made ruler over the world. For Osiris so loved his own son that he gave him dominion over all things. This is intellect, or the power of reason, given dominion over the works of consciousness. We know from the ancient manuscripts and from the various appellatives applied to these deities that everything that we have said is actually included among the titles given to these deities. Therefore, we are not exaggerating. Horus, among his titles, includes the only begotten of Osiris. Also, another title is the firstborn of eternity. Another title of him is he who shall bear witness. Another title of him is the Redeemer. Still another, the Intercessor. He is also called the Bridge and the Door. And it is said of him that he guards the house of his Father. By the time you add maybe 100 or 200 of these appellatives together, you begin to get a fairly accurate concept of what the Egyptian was attempting to convey. The third aspect of Osiris was called Osiris Lunist, and he is represented, ornamented, and adorned with the lunar crescent. Osiris Luna was worshipped as the nocturnal sun, or the sun of the night. And from the terms and appellatives again, we find that he is the lord of the astral light and presides over the mystery of imagination. He is therefore Osiris of desire, Osiris the beloved. He is the one who emerges as the great dreamer, the one whose dreams are always true. He represents the entire internal, subjective, psychological life of both man and the universe. He is the Osiris of hope, of faith, and of the great desire. He is the Osiris who rejoices in the music of the sistrum. He is the Osiris of drama, who wears the masks of many faces. He is the Osiris who moves with the spring and brings forth the harvest. He is the Osiris who is the spirit of growth. He is also the one who giveth his beloved sleep, so that those in their dreams may come to him. He is strangely a mystical deity. A deity not to be known by the reason, but to be found in the strange vistas of sleep. Something, as we find in their ancient writing, that is to be known by the doing. Now there's an interesting term, that which is to be known by the doing. It looks as though what the Egyptian is reaching for is our concept of experience. that God, that power, which is experienced by man when he seeks within himself the source of life, when he moves from the objective to the subject, he passes into the strange white path of the moon that leads in and away into the secret gardens of hope, where the shrine of the great God stands. Altogether, the symbolism, the poetry, the constant recurrence of the strange subtle drama of these nocturnal ceremonies celebrated upon islands for the lights of torches tell us something of the mystical yearnings and longings and convictions of this ancient people. The fourth deity, or the fourth form of the god, is Osiris Typhon. Now, the Egyptian recognized Typhon as the principle of evil, or the principle of destruction. And from his name has come our word, Typhon, the great storm, the tremendous agitation of the elements. Actually, as we have said, the Egyptian did not believe in a principle of evil. He did not believe that Osiris was evil. He believed that Osiris in substance, as universal consciousness, was infinite good. Yet he makes what he would term evil, or what we regard as evil, as an attribute of this power. It has no separate existence. It is a condition of good. To the Egyptian, Osiris Python represented frequently by the famous water horse, or the hippocampus, the hippopotamus of the Nile, living in water, mud, and slime, a strange, grotesque, ungainly creature, was the proper and natural and inevitable symbol for that broad term we now cover by the word matter. Osiris Typhon was the material or physical world, the physical body of things. We can thus understand why the god is represented with a living head adorned with the plumes of victory, his hands holding the triple scepters of the three worlds, but the lower parts of his body covered with the wrappings of the dead. These wrappings of the dead are the vista or sphere or world of Osiris Python, the abode of the dead. Thus, to the Egyptian, the material world was the nearest thing to evil that he could conceive. And yet we have already said that he loved it, that he did not view material life as punishment. He reviewed it, he considered it as a natural course of things. Yet he could not fail to realize that this material world is a sphere of conflict, a sphere in which values are frequently obscured, a sphere in which life and death seem to be struggling constantly for dominion. And the great struggle of life and death is the typhoon. It is the tremendous whirlwind in the midst of which man finds himself. After the death of Typhon, who is finally overcome by Horus, this adversary takes upon himself the form of the great serpent, Apep. And as the great serpent becomes the seducer, or the tempter, it is this fallen serpent, which occurs again and again in their mythology, and in one of the later forms of the Egyptian ritual, the deity Horus is depicted holding a spear and standing upon the back of the serpent Apep, having driven his spear through the head of the creature. In another case, he is shown standing with one foot upon the serpent's head. And we are reminded of the somewhat similar, if though not identical, parallel that the woman shall bruise the head of the serpent, which we have in our Christian religion, and which becomes much more meaningful if we begin to understand the symbolism of Apep. So Osiris now becomes, rather obviously, the four conditions which make up the world. These conditions being consciousness, intellect, desire, and matter. And there is no doubt in any way that the Egyptian had attained this realization and was fully able to handle its implications and to extend it into the most abstract vistas of philosophy. Man, therefore, born into this world, came under the power of Typhon in one of his phases, attributes, or forms. As such, he became a subject, a vassal, or a servant of the prince of this world. Later, perhaps, the Greek emperors or the Roman Caesars. While here, he must render unto the emperor or to Caesar those things which belong to him. But he also must know that even this material world is part of the body of his blessed God. And therefore, his religion and philosophy began to develop ethical and moral overtones. The struggle to restore the glory of his God in matter. The struggle to discover the glory of his God in himself. The Egyptian faced both of these decisions victoriously. He rose to great heights in his contemplation of these mysteries. Probably all Egyptians did not, any more than all peoples of the modern world make the most of their heritage of wisdom. But the priestly classes, the learned, the leaders, were certainly instructed in these matters. Now, after Osiris had been foully murdered by his own alter ego, his own lower self, his inevitable brother, Typhon, and was raised again from the dead through his own son, the Horus, he became the Lord of the quick and the dead, judging righteous judgment over the beings of the three worlds. The lifetime on earth, so-called, or the mortal reign of the god Osiris, was 28 years, which was the length of his duration, and which Plutarch suggests may be a subtle allusion to the cycle of the moon. After his death, he was divided, his body was divided into 14 parts. Some say 28 again. These parts were scattered throughout creation. And the pilgrimage of Isis, again, the wife, sister, other self of Osiris, gives us another dimension of this strange belief. When a brother and sister rule in Egypt as burial together, each referred to the other, not as burial, not as brother, not as co-regent, but always as myself in another. This is again the very concept of Isis, who is herself in Osiris. Now Isis represents in Egyptian mythology one of the two polarities of nature. The Egyptian looking out around him in the world beheld nature divided into two parts, nature above him and nature below him. He saw the air and the sky and the stars, and he saw Isis in the form of the goddess Nut, reaching out across the heavens, forming of her own body the pathway of stars. He also realized that the air was full of life, and perhaps full of spirit. He recognized all things growing from the earth into the air, passing therefore from an underworld to an upper world. And the growth toward the air, or upward into the air, was always toward the sun. In the Egyptian mythology, of course, Osiris is a solar symbol. The eye of Horus, or the Osirian eye, of course, is the single eye of the solar orb. Therefore, Osiris, riding in the great ship of the sun, floats across the heavens, diffusing his life and light through the mysterious reaches of the upper atmosphere, the ethers of space, the great sea of heavenly waters which envelops the earth. The sea, water, was anciently called Mari, Mary, Isis, Isis. Therefore, Isis is the great diffusion of ethereal nature through which the sun's eternal and energies and life forever flow. Now, Isis has a sister, and this sister is Nephthys. And Nephthys bears upon her head a throne surmounted by a bowl, or a low, shallow dish. This bowl is the symbol of the under half of the earth's surface. Therefore, the above and the below are sisters. And where one ends, the other begins. And the energies which flow through space flow also downward into the earth, which is the abode of Nephthys. And the deity Nephthys later was revived among the Greeks as Hecate, the goddess of the underworld. Nephthys, sister, wife of Osiris, sister of Isis, sister of Anubis, of Typhon, sister and mother, nurse of Horus, all these attributes are interchangeable between Isis and Nephthys. And when Osiris is seated upon the great throne in the hall of the twin truths, as Lord of the quick and the dead, Isis stands upon one side of him and Nephthys upon the other. And they are the ancient counselors, and they are the ones who must say, "We are content." The above and the below must agree. The interior and the exterior must agree. The superior and the inferior must agree. And this again, perhaps, is of the basis of the great Hermetic axiom: that which is above is like unto that which is below. That which is below is like unto that which is above. And of this mystery is the generation of all things. Now, where the bowl of heaven above meets the rim of earth below, there is the long line of the mountains. Now, these mountains, or perhaps only the open sea, but there is the wall between the above and the below. And on this roaring ridge of division between that which is superior and that which is inferior, there stands another deity, who is really the product of the mingling. And this deity is Anubis, born of the sky and the earth, and standing forever upon the horizon of the sun. This is a very profound bit of thinking. For what is Anubis? Anubis is the jackal one, who principally lives in the night and is forever crying in the darkness. Anubis is also the faithful guardian protector and friend of this godly family. Because after all, he is only, again, Osiris, as Anubis. He is part. He is not another deity. He is another phase of the deity. Now out of light and darkness, the above and the below, and their strange minglings, comes the being who is to be restored to us in one system of mythology after another. In the Grail cycle, he is Gurnamond, the old knight, who guards the destinies of choirs. In the Arthurian cycle, he is Merlin the magician, who goes to sleep in a house of crystal. In the Divine Comedy of Dante, he is Virgil, conducting the soul through the mystery of the underworld. In the mystery rituals of the ancients, he was the guide, the instructor, and also the one who vouched for the right of the candidate to advance into the rituals. He is still preserved in secret society rituals of this day. Anubis, then, is old and wise. Wise with the wisdom of the sky and the earth. Wise with the wisdom that comes from the motion of the sky upon the earth and the earth upon the sky. Or the motion of invisibles upon visibles and contrary. How invisible causes bring visible things into being, and how all visible things change and modify the invisible worlds of which they are a part. So old Gurnamond, or Anubis, is wisdom, standing upon the horizon between light and darkness, the guardian of souls, the protector of the dead. Now when Osiris in his great ship of light passes triumphantly across the sky, accompanied by his retinue of attributes, because all these deities are parts of himself. He rides in a ship that has an eye upon it, because obviously the boat must see the way in which it is going. The Chinese do the same thing. They always put a pair of eyes on the front of their junks, because obviously ships will want to know the proper direction of travel. When this ship comes finally to the great gate of the west, it descends into the underworld. And when it reaches the edge of the underworld, there stands Anubis on the horizon to salute the dying sun of the world and the rebirth of the invisible sun. Now let's realize what happens. For it is said that the sun, when it goes to sleep, or the great ship goes downward beyond the horizon, that it enters into the plains of Aru, the House of Shadows. And the House of Shadows has 15 gates, leading in all directions. But there are two gates that are most great. And one is the gate of the diminishing, or of the departing, which is the great gate of the west. For into that gate passes the solar ship, when darkness comes upon the earth. The regency of the world is turned over from the Osirian sun to the Osirian moon. The other gate is the great gate of the dawning, the gate of the east. And in the mysteries of the world of Alu, of all the gates, these are the two that the souls of men must most regard. For it is written in the Book of the Breathings that those who pass to sleep through the gate of the west will after a time depart from the underworld, like the great ship of the sun, through the triumphant gate of the east. Therefore, all things who go down with the sun will rise with the sun. and all souls that go down into sleep will awaken again when the great ship of the soul reaches the eastern gate of the horizon. Now we realize then, as we study it, that the ship of Osiris is actually the great ship of the doctrine of Eastern Buddhism, particularly of the Mahayana, or the great vehicle. It is also the Navis, or great ship of Christendom, because the early cathedrals were fashioned in the form of the structure of a ship. We know that this is the ship of salvation, the ship of the redeemed. And in this ship, with Osiris triumphant, ride the souls of the justified dead. Having therefore somewhat established now our mundane and submundane geography, we can go on to a little more of the psychological phase of this. The land of Alu, the land where the spiders of darkness spin their webs, is like the body of Osiris, divided into 14 parts. These parts are no longer referred to, however, as planes or worlds or states or countries or even counties. These parts are referred to in the Egyptian ritual as houses. Therefore, there are 14 houses of the dead. The 14 houses of the dead are referred to in the book of the Breath of Life. And in it, it is said that in the great land of Osiris, there are many houses. And therefore, that in this land, there is an abode proper to each and to all. It is almost identically the same statement. In my Father's house are many mansions. And this great land that is guarded by the gates of Alu is called Amenhotep, which means, literally, the support of Amen. And the word Amen, in this case, is certainly the cause and source of our religious, we might say, formula, or strange invocational word, Amen. Amenhotep, then, is the land of Amen.